Welcome everyone to Fundamentals of Metrology and Characterization for Nanotechnology. This webinar is brought to you by the NAC Network, which was established at the Penn State College of Engineering, and it's funded in part by a grant from the National Science Foundation. This webinar is hosted by Matech Networks, and my name is Mike Lisecki, and I work at Matech Networks. It's really my pleasure today to introduce to you today's presenter, Dr. Diane Hickey Davis. As you can see, she's from Nanoscience Instruments. She has a PhD, and her experience spans a whole gamut of things. Diane, would you tell us a bit more about yourself? And we've got some other interesting pictures, both of you and your family there. So tell us a little bit about that.
Yes. So I've been involved with nanotechnology pretty much for my entire career, but especially the past several years. The picture here is from my work with a thin film nanotechnology diamond company, and a lot of my graduate work was in man-made diamonds. So it was part of material science. During that time, I used a lot of the instruments that we'll be talking about today. One of the poll questions that we'll come up with is, who are you? And I'm giving you some examples, as they will also be in my presentation later. Giovanni is our 2.5-year-old son, and if he were on here, he's not, he's in daycare, but if he were on here, he'd be a student. And you'll also see a few things from my husband, Mike Davis, who is an administrator. He and I met at a nanotechnology outreach conference sponsored by the NSF back in 2006. And the interesting thing about Giovanni is he was never nano-sized. We'll talk a lot about size today as well. All right. Well, one of the titles that we considered for this webinar is how do we see what we can't see? When you talk about nanotechnology, in the title nano, we're talking about scale, and all of our conversations are around scale. But as we saw even on the new template here, images are so much a part of our nanotechnology conversation, including even in science in general. Being on the cover of Science now is just this amazing deal, and that's always an image. So let's talk about, you know, when we talk about nanotechnology, we can't see these things. They're too small. So how do we see them? So today we're going to cover five, and I say common, nanotechnology instruments. These are for imaging, not particularly for experimentation or things. But these are ones that many people are familiar with. We've seen, we might not have known that we've seen a different kind of microscope image, but we'll talk about each one. And for each, we'll talk about, you know, what it does, how it works, where it's used, what subjects it can be used for teaching, and what skills possibly your students can take away to their next educational institution or to industry with them. This next slide, for those of you who have been in kind of nanotechnology for a while, it might look familiar. This is from the Department of Energy. They published this in 2006, talking about the scale of things. And it's very helpful when you're talking about scale to talk about things in the natural world that we can identify with, ants and red blood cells. So we're kind of familiar with these things, but maybe not the scale. You see the red blood cells, they're at this micro world scale of about 8 nanometers, where an ant is at a macro world, as we call it. And then when you get down to the nano world, we talk about atoms of silicon. And on this side, we talk about things that are man-made on the same type of scales. So the way that we've structured today's webinar is that we're going to talk about 5 microscopes that kind of walk us down from the world that we're very familiar with down to the world that is completely nano and maybe even sub-nano, if you will, down to the angstrom level. So the 5 microscopes I've chosen, and again, these are choices, but they are relatively common, is the optical microscope, which a lot of us are very familiar with. But we'll talk a little bit about the 3D optical, which will move us into a nanoscale as well as the macroscale. So some of the common fears, again, cost is probably the largest one we're seeing with budget. But when you get past that, and if you have a budget, you know, people are concerned about industry I'm glad we saw some, you know, would it be useful? I don't really know what it does. So here is, I think, a scary image of a kind of old school transmission electron microscope. So that might be something that we worry about. And then how much does something like that cost? So that is a concern. So the purpose of today's discussion is that hopefully we'll alleviate some of these fears and provide some information about what these things do and how you can use them. And I imagine that we'll get some questions about how much they cost later on. So, as I said, with each instrument, we're going to go through these 5 points. So let's just jump right in, since I already tried to get there, to optical images. Now, when we first talk about optical, the thing we think about is what we see with our eye. And right up here, initially, let me see if I can get a pointer. There we go. Right here, there's the picture of the fly, which could be taken with an iPad or something with a zoom. But when you take an optical microscope, you can actually see you can magnify, but only in a singular plane. There are optical microscopes now, and they're called 3D, that can actually do a lot more, but with true color. So you can really zoom in and see the eye like this, with the hair next to it. You can see a large field of view and very deep about the wing. And also, as you see with this 3D image over here, the back of the fly, and you can see the green color. So you still have the color that you would normally get. But you can also see a little bit more as far as visualizing in the 3D realm what it looks like at a higher scale. So we'll go through each of these. But basically, an optical microscope that has that 3D functionality adds this extra dimension. It works by taking slices, just the same way an optical would, except then adding this degree of slicing through the image. And it's being used in several places. High-tech manufacturing, quality control, and failure analysis. So here's a little bit of how it works. I think many of you are familiar with this optical image, even if when we're in grade school, we're using a traditional optical microscopes. But by moving the knob on the side of the microscope, we can move the focal plane up and down. But the rest of it tends to be blurry. We have one bit in focus and one bit blurry. With these new optical microscopes coming out that enable this 3D feature, you also get to have this infinite focus, as they call it, both with every plane that you're seeing in focus. So you can really get a good idea of the entire field of view and what it looks like in three dimensions. But what's even better is now you can get some very accurate numbers to measure this with. For example, when you're doing failure analysis of metal parts, I actually was on the phone last week and someone says, well, I'm thinking about using this for in an industrial setting to analyze failure mechanisms for metal. And I asked, well, is there anything around here that I can, you know, use to simulate this failure mechanisms that you're trying to analyze? And he's like, oh yeah, do you have a pop top on, you know, an aluminum can? Can you break it off and show me that break point and let's see what that looks like? I'm like, oh yeah. So I've picked this was the drink I had around and the microscope we're using for it. And you see this box right here is just the difference than what you're used to seeing with an optical microscope, and that now allows the 3D functionality. And the results we get when we're looking at failure analysis with metal parts with an instrument like this is this infinite focus, so where everything's in focus, and this is true color, it's kind of like that bluish gray of an aluminum, but you also see this exact same spot represented here in 3D with false color, with the dark colors being the bottom, if you will, and the red being the highest points, the top. And that's the final place where the pop top broke off. And as I said, it gives you a lot of data. Because of the way that it collects data, there is accurate quantitative results that you can now, rather than just saying, oh, this looks one way, you can actually say, ah, it's this high or it's this far or this wide. Very, very accurately, and by getting all of your information pretty much in one view here. Some other areas where it's used is semiconductor parts, semiconductor analysis. The Southwest Center for Microsystems Education produces these electronic sensing circuits, and they were nice enough at the recent high-tech conference to give me a couple. And, well, as in travel, one of them broke, and when I got to put it under this instrument, we got to see some of the failure analysis here, how it breaks, where what parts moved. Here's a MEMS device from Argonne National Lab. Now, Argonne's very close to me, and they do a lot of MEMS work. And this is, again, similar to the sensor we just saw. This part here and here is actually a membrane that floats. And this squiggly section is actually acting as a spring, so it can give feedback to the researchers about how heavy or what force is pressing on this membrane. Now, you have four windows here. You have this 3D version with this white plane cutting through it. And so that way you can see, let me move the arrow, you can see what's higher and lower. That actually corresponds to this number one line up here, which where everything looks flat and you don't know higher or lower. You could guess, but it helps referring to the 3D image. And again, this is true color. So there was a green nitride layer on the edge that was flat. They probably used it for patterning. And the silver is silicon. Over here, these lines on the line graph on where there's data actually correspond to the lines over on your 2D view and gives quantitative data about where you are in 3D space, and then also down here it gives the actual numbers. Now, this is obviously really great for industry, but also if you're teaching students who might be going on to engineering, it's very important to be able to imagine and use your imagination and understand how 3D space relates to what data I'm getting. And this is also true if you have students that might be going on to graduate school and moving right along to understanding XY axes, and if they have to take the GRE, there's a lot of need to understand how something in reality corresponds to what you're charting. So an instrument like this can really help with that. Companies like 3M use a 3D optical profiler to do quality control and quality assurance. This image, it might not look like it. I should probably have you guess what it was, but it's sandpaper that I got from Home Depot. And they'll actually use this to do measurements of roughness. And this is really where you do this stretch between what's in the macro world of what we can see to the micro world. And then for roughness, this instrument can actually get down to the tens of nanometers. So this is the connection to the nano world that we're reaching for. And I see the question about how long does it take for a student to get confident of that. Well, we can talk about that later with the students and how long, but right now we have students that are competent in a few hours if it's constant. And then there are some high school students who are using it in the classroom, and I think it took them 145-minute class to get some initial results. But again, this is really being used in industry. It's optical is quite pervasive, and I think that all students in any kind of sciences, engineering, or even going on to a biology area probably should be familiar with optical. But now let's leave the optical and really move into the micro world. And I hope, I couldn't hear it, Mike, but I hope maybe I heard some oohs and ahs when we switched. That tends to be very common.
Yeah.
You heard one? normally, the first time you see an electron microscope image, everybody's like, oh, wow. So this is actually an ant. And Lisa Del Muro, who is at Wheeling High School, tweeted a couple weeks ago that she got this wow as soon as they moved it into the electron microscope. And her students did ask, why was the image in black and white? And we'll actually get to that. A scanning electron microscope is extremely common when you talk about nanotechnology. It does span this micro world and down into the nano world. And I could spend a lot of time explaining what it does, but I'd much rather have Abby from NCIS do it for me.
GIPS, Meet my new main squeeze. This is Ken, the SEM. My new scanning electron microscope. This baby can magnify up to 500,000 times.
Mm-hmm. Say anything good?
Pollen.
Pollen?
It's only the biggest forensic science breakthrough since DNA. And this isn't just any pollen. It's a specific strain of the Cortulinae fruticosa. See, every plant has its own fingerprint, as specific and unique as DNA. This pollen came from Petty Officer Bick's lung tissue.
This helps us how?
Pollen is embedded in everything, and it stays embedded for months. It's nearly impossible to wash off. It sticks using these microscopic little hooky things.
Meaning?
Meaning, I can track where someone's been and who they've been in close contact with simply by looking at the pollen spores that are in their clothes and their hair and their
abs.
The pollen that was in Petty Officer Bick's lungs is found only one place on Earth.
Diego Garcia.
Well, Diane, that's a pretty interesting explanation, isn't it?
She gets awfully excited. And that's what you would hope when you're talking about electron microscopy. It is really a powerful tool for seeing things at the nanoscale. And I love how she says these microscopic hooky thingies, because I think we use that term sometimes when describing how the gecko is attached to the walls.
Right, it's a very technical term. Right.
Oh, yes, very, very. Right. Used in nanotechnology all the time.
Right, go ahead.
So, a scanning electron microscope works, rather than using light, it uses electrons, and it scans the surface, and then there's a detector or a sensor here that actually gets these almost reflected, if you will, electrons and recreates an image. Now, we ask the question, why is it black and white? So, I want the audience to think. Why is it black and white? Why would the electron microscopy image that we use for so many things be black and white when the optical used color? And the students asked the exact same thing. There's no color on the electron microscope. So let's go back way, way back and try to remember, how does color work again? Okay, so I found this. Everyone can print this out and title your paper and record your observation of why does an apple look red. So this might have been something we got in grade school to, as a test, to ask us to regurgitate why an apple looks red. So just to remind us a little bit about how we see things, we pick up using our eyes a visual part or a certain part, and we call it the visible scale, of the electromagnetic spectrum of a particular wavelength. And my apologies, this is upside down. I couldn't find one that went from blue on the bottom to red. But blue being the shortest wavelength we see, and red being the longer ones. And because of things that are wavelengths absorbed by the apple and not absorbed, then reflected to our eyes, we can reconstruct that an apple looks red. With an electron microscope, we're actually down in this area called gamma rays, and for the distance, the shorter rays. And that's where we have the electrons that can, now since we have a shorter wavelength, see much smaller things. But I can hear some of you, even though you're not typing in the chat box, going, well, technically, in electron microscopes, the kinetic energy gained by an electron, well, yes, technically you're right. It is a little bit more complicated than my picture, but it's an analogy. And for the scanning electron microscope, it does work. And we'll talk also about the electron microscope with the transmission later, and it uses a higher voltage. But this is just to show you that for those of you saying that it's more complicated than that, thank you. This is the approach. But more importantly for our audience, Mike, I think it's important to say where it's used. And right now, the scanning electron microscope is used in almost every technology field and scientific field today. Additionally, and I think you're going to help me here with a movie, it's really being used a lot in forensic analysis.
Thank you.
finding the dog?
Not yet, but his broken leash is another story. Since I couldn't figure out what could have cut the leash without leaving tool marks, I decided to take a closer look. Found a repetitive pattern with a break along a single plane, which means the metal was extremely brittle.
Like it was frozen.
Yeah. It's definitely a match. Liquid nitrogen snapped the leash. And I'm thinking it's also what caused Fiona's heart to freeze.
Yeah, the shape and diameter of the stab wound could be consistent with the nozzle of a liquid nitrogen tank,
allowing direct access to her heart. Now, a tank nozzle is very blunt, so the killer must have used tremendous force to push it all the way through Fiona's cardiac wall.
There are liquid nitrogen tanks on street corners all over the city. The utility companies use them to maintain power lines and reduce corrosion.
You know what else liquid nitrogen is used for?
So we're back, Diane. So apparently they solved the crime.
Yes, continues on for a little while, and much like Abby, they get very excited about their electron microscope show, as you should be. And we've been using the electron microscope. So this is how it used to be when you would use the SEM in education. Maybe you'd go to the university and have a tour of the lab, and this kind of looks maybe the 70s, about what it was. So this is what an electron microscope would have looked like a while back. But today in education, it's being used in some really neat ways. And I'm video heavy in this one, but if we can go to this video, I think it's well worth it to show what students can do today with an electron microscope, even if you're not on a TV show.
So, what should we look at? Yeah, just put it on there. All right. Make sure it's submerged. And there we go. Just a few seconds, and let's see if we can find the hair.
Whoa.
Yeah, there it is. So now you know what we can do. I think it would be a good idea if you go and find something yourself.
Okay, so I think that video actually shows really good representation of the subjects you can use if you're using a scanning electron microscope or if you're using one remotely and working with maybe a university or a center who can do some analysis for you. It's a nice combination of what a student can actually see with their eyes, but then also going to that truly microscopic or nanoscale world of something beyond. SEM in industry is actually becoming much more common than it used to be, mostly because of some smaller sizes and some less expensive pieces of equipment. The aerospace world uses it quite a bit for their alloys that they study, HEPA filters like this fiber sample shown here. In medical, you can image bacteria. Semiconductors, it's always been used quite a bit. When you talk about nodes in semiconductor are getting the smaller and smaller transistors, right now I think we're on maybe the, you know, somewhere around the 20 nanometer range for a transistor size, so extremely small, even smaller than some SEMs can image right now. Metal filters and pharmaceuticals, it's being used quite a bit. One of the challenges here, I'm glad someone asked about sample prep. One of the challenges here is typically you cannot put something wet or moisturous within a scanning electron microscope because it is under vacuum. There are some ways around that, and there are some environmental SEMs. But in general, sample prep can be one of the more challenging aspects of this. It's not as easy as just sticking something underneath the optical microscope. Also, as we've seen in nano quite a bit, we will see these colorized SEM images, and they make for great art. In fact, the Materials Research Society every year has science as art competitions at each of their meetings, and many of the images they get are colorized SEM images. And some people, since I just said SEM, some people say SEM or SEM. You can tomato, tomato, you know, whichever you prefer. In teaching, I have several different areas who are using it, from high school to outreach to two-year schools and obviously four-year schools for research. But here is just one at Occidental College, and they're using it for introduction biology and also some other activities, but getting some very nice images. Also using a Western New England University for the chemistry courses and student research. And here you can see one of the neat things they've done is they've mounted the TV on the wall so that more than one person can be looking at a time. Really useful for teaching. And then it's just great for cool stuff that you break. We had a light bulb burn out in our lab, so we pulled out the tungsten filament. I mean, who wouldn't if you have a microscope around? And you put it in, and these are some amazing images that you get of the tungsten, of the filament on the inside of a light bulb, and the fatigue and how it broke, which is just pretty fascinating. But that kind of shows that I'm just a little bit of a nerd. So I think now's a good time. We've gone over two instruments, Mike. I think we had a couple of questions. Do you want to pick ones out that
I do? And by the way, I just want to mention you're perfectly on time at this segment, just to let you know. You know, not only the question is, does this thing take the image, but what about image analysis? I mean, what are there options, or how does it work?
That's a great question. For most instruments, it does take the image, and it might have some ability to adjust the image. But as I mentioned with the SEM, and when you're colorizing it, you would bring that over to a Photoshop or something else. There are several other image analysis tools available, both for free and ones that you can purchase. The NIH has sponsored something called ImageJ, and that's a free tool online that a lot of people in the bio world use.
Very interesting. So yeah. There's a
thanks, Dan.
An obvious thing. You know, you've got that image as a file, right? And you can just go ahead and do all kinds of things with it. You know,
right. And that depends on the tools, but most of these can save obviously straight as a JPEG and then have a more extensive file.
Right. Do you know that many of us out there are thinking the same thing, right? How long is it going to take? You already partially answered this. For a student to actually learn how to use this stuff, and for the optical microscope, you mentioned it could be actually pretty fast. What about the SEM? That sounds more complicated. how much training time before a student could actually be using it themselves? I don't mean every little feature.
Sure. No, this is a good question. That's what I want to say. There's the basic features and the advanced. One thing that really has come about in the last 5 years is this idea of desktop microscopes across the board, really. And when you talk about scanning electron microscopes, most people think of a large room with a large microscope and a vibration isolation table, and that you have to take a 6-month course before you can go and use this, which was my experience in graduate school way back when I did graduate school. But today, there are these desktop microscopes that are both more affordable and also much quicker to learn. There's that one video that I showed of students using the touch screen and quickly learning how to zoom. It's actually quite an interesting, strange thing. It's quicker for me to train a teenager on the desktop scanning electron microscopes today because of the touch screen and their ease of the interface than it is for me to take it to an industrial area and teach an operator who might be a little bit older, have been using an optical microscope for 40 years. They're afraid to touch it. They're afraid to touch the screen, that's electronics. So it might take them a little bit longer, but you can get quite proficient within 15 minutes to an hour on one of these desktop systems.
You know, it is true. These students are used to these graphical user interfaces that come with today's modern tools, you know, that they don't even think about it. They just start using it, you know.
They just jump right in.
Yeah.
And then that brings you back to the, oh, we're worried we're going to break it. And so, again, it is based on design, but a lot like the iPad, the interface should allow you to make it as unbreakable as possible.
If you're out looking to buy an SEM, and what sort of features should you look for? I mean, I should know this, but do they come like with its ultimate resolution? You know, this one will resolve down to 100 nanometers. This one will resolve down to 50. How are they characterized? What's a key performance feature that one looks for when purchasing an SEM?
It's a good question. Magnification and resolution always come up, and they're difficult sometimes to define, but magnification is how much you can go. For an optical like your iPad, you can digitally zoom, and you'll also have that with the SEMs. The desktop systems typically do a magnification of up to 30,000 times, and some of them go even up to 100,000 times, and that's really getting into the smaller, large systems, if you will. The larger SEMs that you'll find in a university setting can resolve down to maybe 2 nanometers and such. It gets very small. But your desktop systems will be more in the 50 nanometer, 20 nanometer, sometimes sub 20 nanometer range.
Okay. One of the questions says, what are the detectors? I think it refers to SEM. What are the detectors, and how does that connect with the final image, or do you have options of detectors? I actually don't know the answer to that.
That's a good question. With the scanning electron microscope, there are typically two kinds of detectors for the image. There is a secondary electron detector, and that's normally used for conductive samples. So sometimes you'll hear in sample prep, you need to coat your sample with a conductive layer of gold or carbon to make it electrically conductive. And that means just that the analogy to white light, if you have something too bright, it's going to just all be white and you can't see anything. If you have a non-conductive sample, something that will accumulate charge, then the detector will be not able to resolve anything different, so you might have to coat your sample. So a secondary electron detector is one, and a backscatter detector is another. And on the physical level of how they work, so everybody out there going, well, technically, they do work differently, but they can provide the same image. The backscatter detector adds a little bit more by providing some elemental analysis, because elements that are higher on the periodic table or larger or heavier actually show up brighter in a backscattered image. So if you are a rubber company and you're looking for contaminants, or a filter company and you're looking for metal contaminants, the little specks of metal in a backscatter detector will just be super bright compared to the background.
That's cool. That's very cool. You know, we've got a question which I'm going to save to the second one that talks about use of this of these oscopies for various chemical analyses. But let's come back to that one. Diane, take us forward.
Okay. So we were talking about the scanning electron microscope, and this is a question, again, for the audience. You don't have to answer in the chat, just quietly to yourself. What do you think this is an SEM image of? Or if you want to chat, go right ahead. But possibly the 2D SEM image doesn't help you much. Let's try a 3D atomic force microscope image. This takes us to yet a smaller level. This is 10 microns here across. Well, I'm glad that it's pretty. That's really what we're trying to accomplish. But the 3D version is really nice. And I saw somebody type in the answer. It is a DVD. Very good. Somebody has been paying attention to their nano classes. So these small dots and dashes might remind you of an SOS code, but that's a good analogy. It's for zeros and ones, and that's how the computer can relate to what's being put on this DVD. When I first started talking to educational institutions about ASM, they were really like, you know, is ASM essential to nano? If I'm running a nanotechnology course, do I have to have this ASM? And that's a great question. The scanning electron microscope does go through a little bit larger range in the scale of things. And the scanning probe microscopes, and an atomic force microscope is one of the scanning probe microscopes. And it does go down to this nano range much better. But the ASM really has become the poster child for nano. I don't know if we can do a, you could raise your hand if you've ever played with a model, a Lego model, or a coffee cup model. And I don't know if we didn't talk about raising your hand. But, you can actually click that and say, have you ever used an ASM model like this Lego one?
Lots of us have. Sorry for the dinging in the background, folks, but a lot of us have raised our hands, Diane.
Yeah. Sorry about the dinging. I didn't know that would happen. But that's great. That's what I thought. A lot of people have used a model of an atomic force microscope. It just seems to have captured our imagination that this small, tiny tip can actually image atoms. And this is a new image I found the other day with the made using a fib and an ASM. I thought
that was
pretty
cool
with the snowman. And then these great images coming out of the NIVES network from the graphite pencil lead all the way down to the graphene sheets or the sheets with atoms. Really showing you the scale. But an ASM, for what it does, you guys pick the recording media. It actually, you can study defects. So Giovanni loves to help us load and unload the CDs and the DVDs and the Blu-rays. And we wonder why they can't play after he slid it across the floor. This is why. It ends up looking like this on a nanoscale. But in simple terms, the atomic force microscope works by scanning the sharp probe over an instrument. And here's where you get some really technical people. Well, actually, the probe tip isn't touching. It's the atoms are interacting with each other, and there's force between them and things like that. But we do use these models quite a bit. In fact, at my last company, the CEO of this diamond company where we were making all diamond ASM probes, he would often use the analogy of, oh, it's like a record player. Like you have that needle going across the record. And immediately some of us will go, well, no, that's not accurate because truly the probe is not touching the surface. But your deep thought for today, at a nano level, at the nano scale, does the tip of a record player actually touch the record? So this is your deep thought that you can bring to your parties tonight and discuss. But moving right along, we're going to go to another animation, kind of showing you in real time what the probe is doing on an atomic force microscope and how it's creating this 3D image.
Non-contact atomic force microscopy. 1. Finding the surface.
The microscope's cantilever is activated to vibrate resonance. As it is lowered, attractive forces between the tip and the sample alter the cantilever vibration. The cantilever returns to its unperturbed vibration when withdrawn from the sample. The set point for the cantilever vibration determines the distance between the tip and the sample for imaging. 2. Scanning principle. If the tip is scanned across the sample, the tip height is adjusted by feedback to keep the cantilever vibration at the set point and the distance between the tip and the sample constant. 3. Scanning the sample. As the tip is raster scanned across the sample, the tip height is adjusted to keep the cantilever vibration at the set point, and so the tip follows the topography of the sample. The height of the tip is recorded along with the coordinates of its point in the scan. 4. The resulting map of tip position can then be processed to render an image of the sample topography with nanometer resolution.
Great. And for those of you who have done models, you're probably pretty familiar with that rastering mechanism. And also probably one of the things you talk about a lot when you're talking about using a probe is the sharpness of the probe measures how accurate your resolution can be. And here there's a very sharp probe showing that it does follow the balls very closely. And then if you have a larger, wider probe, it doesn't have as high as this is what we call resolution. So this is, again, something you can talk about and reinforce from basic concepts about how things are working on that scale. But with the atomic force microscope, we tend to talk a lot about how it works. And this is one microscope that I think most nano people are familiar with, how the AFM works, but not what do we use it for. So I wanted to talk a little bit about the uses that it's being used for in industry. One large one is particle analysis. So the AFM, even better than the scanning electron microscope, can discern these nanometer-sized particles. And this is used quite a bit in cosmetics and hair care. And in fact, I just saw something about the microparticles being used in a lot of skin care exfoliation, that's the word I'm looking for, is ending up in the Great Lakes and floating because they're made of plastic. So they're talking about, you know, trying to get those plastic microbeads out of products. In medical, it's very important for drug delivery because I think a lot of people understand that the way that your body interacts with items has a lot to do with the surface roughness or the scale. And then in industry, structural additives or catalysts, especially the smaller the catalyst, like the nanoparticles, the higher your surface area, the faster the reaction. So that's what the AFM is used for. So this also nanotubes. Again, another poster child of the nano movement are these carbon nanotubes. We talk about buckyballs. We talk about CNTs, multi-walled and single-walled carbon nanotubes. And really the first time you can see an individual nanotube is when you come down to this atomic force microscope scale. But they're being embedded. I remember getting a tennis racket with carbon fiber or nanofibers in it. I was very excited. So this is how you would analyze, you know, how much nanofiber you have and possibly your matrix. And it's also used for bone scaffolding and then some other options as well. Now, back to questions of color, and I think color is a theme today. This is a question I had. Why are all the AFM images orange? Well, they're not. It's not a trick question. They do seem to be orange. I went out on YouTube, and I'm like, okay, most of these atomic force microscopes can enter this shades of orange. But basically, it's a grayscale. Dark being the lowest point and light being the highest point. It's just showing you for your 3D rendering, but in a 2D visual of what's high and what's low. I did find one other color out there, hot pink. So I'd imagine that possibly on the software you can choose what color you want your AFS images to be, but I found this one that was hot pink with, again, the dark being the bottom and the lightest color being the top, if you will. But this is an image of a CD disc and a DVD disc. So let's bring that. They look very similar, but they're different scales. So speaking of color, let's do a matching game real quick. Again, to yourself, we have a CD, a DVD, and a Blu-ray. And unlike my slide here, they're actually all the same size. Here are three images from the AFM, all with 10 microns wide. And choose which one you think is associated with a Blu-ray and a DVD and a CD. And these are images that my husband took. He had worked with AFMs in graduate school, and when I brought one home from my job, he was super excited that he could use it in our basement. And he took these images. Well, let's think. CD, DVD, a Blu-ray. Ah, here we go with the color. Blu-ray. Like a ray gun? And here's my real genius reference, like a laser ray gun. So blue laser, and that actually does translate to what we're talking about here. The nanometer wavelength, again, of the laser used for Blu-ray is 405, which actually is in the ultraviolet range. And that's where Blu-ray gets its name, a Blu-ray disc, because it's using a blue ray of light at a specific wavelength to go over these very small dots and dashes that translate then to Finding Nemo, which then gets slid off the floor and scratched up, and we can't watch it, and we have to buy a new one. But with a DVD, it goes at 650 nanometers, and that's the associated image on the AFM on the 10 micron scale, and then a CD has less information on it, and its laser is red. I don't know if anyone ever took apart their CDs, or when you first got your CD player, you could actually look in and see the red laser going across the CD surface, and that's using 780 nanometers. So if you didn't learn it, I hope that you learned something today, that a Blu-ray disc comes from the laser used in that. So now we're going to move on to the second to last microscope. Mike, I'm just going to ask you quickly, how are we doing on time?
I would say don't dawdle. We're doing okay, but don't dawdle. We're doing
all
great.
Right.
Thanks.
Well, we're going down to the nano world, so maybe since we're going smaller, we'll go quicker.
Okay. All right.
I don't know.
Thanks.
The next one, thank you. The transmission electron microscope. As I showed you earlier, this is an image of an older model, and you can kind of tell from the design. Today, they look more like this image back here, which is a little bit hidden. But a transmission electron microscope takes images like the one you see here. And while we could get to the nanoscale with the last microscope, the atomic force microscope, this is the first time we're really seeing atoms. And here's a cut across, if you can imagine a surface cut across, of silicon atoms and then niobium atoms. This is a crystal structure, and you know it's crystal. Back to our elementary school science, crystal is ordered, an ordered structure of atoms. So a silicon crystal and a niobium crystal, and the interfaces between the niobium nitrogen and the silicon and the niobium. So you're actually looking through the surface and looking at rows of atoms. So if you close your eyes for a second and imagine those ball and stick models that a lot of us have in our classrooms, and you can rotate it, and in some ways, especially with that salt crystal, nice cubic structure, in some ways you're just looking down rows of atoms. You can now open your eyes. That's similar to what you're seeing here. So a transmission electron microscope also allows us to look at things like a poliovirus, something that's very small, 30 nanometers across. And also, I just think this image is fantastic. This is a bacteria, and you can see the surface. And you see this is 200 nanometers, but you really get some nice, nice understanding of what this looks like through the sample. Now, it's often used for metals because metals typically tend to be crystalline. And if you're in a material science program or material science class, we talk about the way that metal fatigues and metal breaks. And so here's an image of steel with the dislocations clearly visible in slip planes clearly visible in the transmission electron microscope. Often also you will see a transmission electron microscope with this image, it kind of looks like a photo, shown at the same time with this crystalline diffraction pattern. And if you thought that my analogy for the SEM to light was not accurate, I'm not even going to try to explain why we have these diffraction patterns. But this is often shown that you're actually looking down a particular plane and you have it aligned correctly. So the way that this works, again, it's an electron microscope. It's using electrons in a source. And with an SEM, and I'm glad somebody asked about the detectors, you can have that backscatter detector or the secondary electron detector. But with a transmission electron microscope, electrons are transmitted through a very thin slice. And this specimen, it has to be about 100 nanometers or less. So it's an extremely thin slice, 0.1 micron. It's a lot like light going through glass. I'm glad you typed that. It's very similar to that. I like the glass idea. I tend to use a piece of paper, but yes, if you have a glass slide, that's a good analogy, and a biological sample, and you had a flashlight above it, and you're projecting down onto a piece of paper, where the light can go through, it goes through and it's bright, where it gets stuck, where the electrons can't penetrate because something's there, and you have this dark, and then in areas where it's kind of in between, you have this in between, and you can adjust all of those functions, all of the knobs on the transmission electron microscope. But that's, in general, very basically how it works. And the things it's being used for is really high-resolution imaging. That's what this HRTEM stands for, high-resolution transmission electron microscope. And this is for lithium-ion batteries. You can see these ordered lines. Those are actually atoms in an ordered way. So you're looking through a crystal, straight through it. And this is probably the carbon area, the 5 nanometers. Now, again, we haven't had a scale bar as small as 5 nanometers yet. So this is really getting down to that nanoscale. And at this point in time, let me go back. TEM is used very much in high research areas, possibly for maybe semiconductors. It might be used in quality control or quality assurance. So now we're going to go to our last microscope, the scanning tunneling microscope. And I'm actually going to go back and talk about that image I first showed you, the scale of things. We're down way at the bottom. And in, as I said, that was published in 2006. But this image by IBM was actually produced using a scanning tunneling microscope back in the late 90s. And it's one of those iconic images in the popular culture. I don't know if that's an oxymoron, but that we will often see this quantum corral that IBM did. Well, so that's the benefit of a scanning tunneling microscope. You can actually, quote unquote, see atoms. And for 15 years, IBM's doing a lot of research with the scanning tunneling microscope. And so we're here, they moved atoms around to make this quantum corral. This summer, they published the next movie we're going to look at.
So, Diane, here we go. This one's just a little bit over a minute. Yes. I saw one of the comments in that video. You know, people post these comments and it says, this can't be, this is a fake because atoms really don't look like that. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, and that's a good reference. Atoms, what do atoms look like if you can't see them? So there are lots of ways to represent atoms, and that's one way. And for those of you, what I'd highly recommend, since somebody were asking about these, go and watch the How That Was Made video. It's really well worth it. It's wonderful. They did a wonderful job in the making of video, but I like that just for really getting excited about this type of instrument, of seeing things you can't see. But here at this scale, when you're looking, quote unquote, looking at atoms, what the scanning tunneling microscope is doing is actually using something, a word we throw around that, you know, possibly very few of us understand, or if we understand, there's probably a lot more we can learn about it, quantum tunneling. So this tunneling current, where you have a current between atoms, but even if the physics behind a lot of this is quite advanced, it can still reinforce just common scientific principles. For example, you see down here it says electrically conductive sample. So you can talk to your students about this. Why does the sample need to be electrically conducting? What does that mean? What does current mean? Well, let's think back to our elementary school where we talked about electricity and how does electricity work and what are electrons and how do they move and what is current and if you put a voltage across something. So even if, you know, you can go into more and more and more and more detail and be more and more and more accurate about how the phenomenon at this level works, first of all, there's still a lot scientists don't know, and second of all, it's still reinforcing some of the basic scientific principles we learned a long time ago. But that, in one way, is the way it works. Here is an artist's rendition of how they moved, pushing these cobalt atoms, I think somebody asked what kind of atom it was, these cobalt atoms around to make that movie. And this is the artist's rendition. And I think one of the really fascinating things about nanotechnology is almost different than any other science. The artists have really gotten involved and helped us understand and translate these scientific instruments into something that our brains can relate to. So the scanning tunneling microscope is really being used in advanced research labs, like by IBM and such. It's used in teaching and outreach. And I'm not really sure if there are any truly industrial research, not researchers, but industrial uses. And what I mean by that is it's not being used in an R&D lab, but it's really being used in a more of a quality control or maybe later stage R&D. But mostly, from what I understand, it's used in advanced research labs. And some teaching it, that there are several classrooms, high school and community college, that have scanning tunneling microscopes in their high schools. However, they're not going to be making movies because that movie was made at, I think, 4 Kelvin, which, as we like to say in Chicago, is as cold as it's going to get when the Cubs win the World Series. So really, really cold. So unless you can get it that cold in your classroom, it's not going to work. Here's another image that many of you might be familiar with looking at in, thank you, in the nano world, these steps in silicon and seeing these atoms. So when you see images like this, possibly you don't always think, how did we get that image? How do we know that's what it looks like? Or what it is like on the surface of silicon, and this is how we use a scanning tunneling microscope. So you use this microscope to image atoms, but what about beyond? I mean, you can teach physics with this a little bit, but what other things can your students learn? One of them being how to conceptualize something that they can't see. You know, what does an atom look like? I saw some people talking about, yeah, atoms don't look like that. And you mentioned that, Mike, too, that was a comment. Atoms don't really look like that. Well, what do they look like? Why don't you think they look like that? And also understanding how a tunneling current can be translated into an image. Operating Delicate equipment. I think that's something that your students can learn by having something like a scanning tunneling microscope. So many times we allow students to not hurt themselves or not break something. We give them scissors that don't have sharp edges. Well, here you go. Here's a real piece of equipment. Let's see what you can do with it. We know you're smarter than we think you are. Let's see you go off and use this. But as far as skills for your students, it's not quite something that they might put on the resume yet. Not nearly as much as they would put an optical microscope on their resume and being able to sell it to a four-year institution, possibly graduate program if they're going into something that uses an STM, but not quite a common resume skill. Now, when we talk about beyond, I think Mike had asked me, what do you mean by beyond? What's beyond an atom? Well, let's use your imagination. Are there things smaller than an atom? What are we going to create? What are your students going to create? What instruments are they going to make where you can see exactly quarks and electrons? There's, what instruments are we going to come up with, or your students are going to come up with, to represent, to image, to model these things that are happening at a level that we can't see? So hopefully some of this excites you and your students to learn things. So here we go with the test. And Mike, I'm going to give it back to you, I think.
Yes, and we're trying something here to see if it works. We don't actually know if it's going to work. Participants, this is like when you were in school, you had to draw a line like a matching column A, column B. So I have given you access to the toolbar, and I might not be pointing to it exactly on your screen. So see, it's the third one down. So there's a little marker pen there. If you click on that marker pen, and then you can actually get access to the drawing tool. If you move slightly to the right, you should be able to activate the pen. So I'd like to see if you can grab the pen and then start. There you go. Somebody's starting to draw lines there. So apparently this is going to work, maybe. So everybody grab that pen and start matching. Well, that top one's the 3D optical. No one's drawing lines from the top one. Oh, there we go. Oh, Diane, this is working. This is really
it's
fun.
Like picture pages.
This is better than I thought. There's not quite the uniformity I thought there would be of the responses here. Oh, this is fun.
Very nice.
You notice how people are choosing different colors and different pen widths to
mm-hmm.
do this? This is interesting. People are drawing smiley faces on the thing. That's what students would do, of course. Oh, I'm really glad we tried this. Of course, now at this point, I can't make any sense of their answers at all.
Right. Well,
you know what, Diane? Yeah.
We publish an answer key later, since it's a test.
Yeah. I'll tell you what. I'm gonna stop this madness here for a moment, and then Diane, I'm gonna ask you. Oh, I wonder if I could clear this image. Holy cow! You think I would know how to do that? Let me just see if I can. Just a second. See if I can. Clear this. I wonder how I do that. Oh, darn it.
That's okay. I can pick another color if you want me to go through this.
Yeah, okay. Well, let's just do it briefly. Just choose something.
Sure.
I'm sorry that I can't clear the darn thing. You think I would know?
No worries. We're going to use, I don't think anybody's used green. So we'll take green. And let's see. Oh, yeah. So let's start with what I'm going to use is the easy one, the SEM. What did we talk about with the SEM? That it's black and white colors. So here you go, the pictures of the ant right over here. So
right,
that's a nice straightforward one.
All right, good.
Then we talked about the 3D images up here. You can see the 3D. Ooh, I can do arrows. Ooh, arrows here. So 3D. Many of these will do, but this is actually with that orange. We come back to the AFM. These colorized images down here.
Yeah.
See, I'm making more of a mess of it than anybody. Also SEM, but colorized. And then with our optical microscope, we have the optical image of the screen and the tunneling microscope with the tunneling image of the steps. All right. So in the last 5 or 6 minutes, we've talked about how we, I mean, this is all about education. That's the NAC network. That's what we're all talking about. But how practical is this to talk about nanotechnology in the classroom setting? I mean, this is what we think about with classrooms. Oops, I need my other pointer back. And this is what we think about when we talk about nanotechnology. Is it really practical to integrate these instruments into a classroom? Especially when we talk about clean rooms. I mean, even in college, when I'll go, you know, when I was going home, my mom would say, you know, keep your room clean. So this is our idea of a clean room. But in the nano world, this is Intel's idea of a clean room. And they are quite different, even the vocabulary. So there are some practical considerations that you have to think about when you're thinking about using this in a classroom setting. The very first thing, and this always, always shocks me, and I don't know why, but classrooms have such a short period of time. Even your labs, there just really isn't a lot of time, especially in a high school. With a 4-year institution and a 2-year institution, sometimes you have a little bit more time. But again, if your instrument has to take 20 minutes to wake up or get ready, that's just not practical. You have to have an instrument that's ready to use quickly if you're going to be using it in the classroom. Another practical consideration when you're looking at instrumentation is, I'm going to say, no user maintenance. And the thing I want you to think about here, and I'm going to highlight, is you. You're going to be the one maintaining it, no matter what they tell you. Think about when your laptop goes down. If you know anything about IT, you're the one fixing the laptop. But what we want you to focus on is being a professional teacher and not an amateur technician. So make sure that the instrument you're purchasing, you're either familiar enough with or it doesn't take any user maintenance. The next thing to think about is infrastructure requirements. If your school is lucky enough to be building a new lab building, then this isn't that much of an issue. But if you're using it in a traditional classroom setting like the one shown in the picture, you want to be able to, and I don't know if you can see the wires, everything plugs into the wall. You want to make sure that it's on like a 110, you know, American scale, just regular, you plug it into the wall, electricity. You don't want anything that requires special wiring. You want basic pumps. You don't want to deal with dangerous chemicals if you're dealing with high school students or your elementary school students. So these are all considerations. When we were talking about the large scanning electron microscopes and transmission electron microscopes, and with IBM doing things at a very low temperature, a lot of those instruments would use liquid nitrogen and liquid nitrogen dewars. You don't want to be filling up a liquid nitrogen dewar in your class. So, you know, keep that in mind as well. Another thing that I think is very important, in nano we use a lot of models. And there's a lot of discussion over if models and analogies are good or not. You know, or are you misrepresenting, like when we're talking about the record player with the needle as an analogy for an AFM. But with all of that modeling going on, if you're going to get an instrument in the classroom, get a real scientific instrument, like that iPad analogy I made. That way, the students can put them on the resume and also say, I used this piece of equipment, and yeah, it's a piece of equipment that you use in industry or that's used in a 4-year institution or in a graduate program. It isn't some kind of dumbed down piece of equipment. So those are all questions that I'd recommend that you ask when you're thinking about instrumentation. And not so much that you ask the question, is it practical, but is it doable? And maybe that's a question you answer for yourself, but I'd like you to consider the people that are already doing it. And especially if you want to follow along, one person that I'm enjoying watching very much is Wheeling High School. Lisa Del Muro is tweeting about her students on these instruments. So you might be able to tweet her or talk to her about how long did it take your students to become proficient. So talk to people who are really doing it and seeing if it's something that you can implement as well. And that brings us back to the scale of things. We went all the way from the macro scale and looked at ants all the way down to looking at a movie made by moving atoms around. So I think that kind of sums it up for me, Mike. Shall we go over some questions?
Yes, I've got a couple here, Diane, and of course we're perfectly on time. Here's a question for you. You get one of these tools, one of these microscopes, and a lot of questions, of course, immediately come up by cost. And I know there's a huge number of factors. There might not be a simple answer. But give us a range. You know, we're looking now at an educational tool. Let's start with a 3D optical. What's that baby going to cost? Just give me a range.
A range for that will be somewhere between $50,000 to $75,000.
$50,000 to $75,000.
Mm-hmm.
How do schools afford these? Do they get grants? Do they get sponsors for these things? How do they
great
come up with
question.
That sort of money?
I'm certainly that's a longer discussion how schools
sure.
get funded.
Sure.
But the classrooms that I've been talking to, especially for in high school, will typically have a very interested industry base or an interested parent base, where they do this kind of fundraising. They feel very strongly that instruments need to be part of the classroom and actual tools. For one school that I'm working with, a lot of their students won't go on to a four-year institution, and a lot of them also won't go on to a two-year, but they will go directly into work for the local industries and as an operator. And these operators are now, like I said, moving from, as these industries are buying these tools, they want, and again, a lot of what the ATE grants are to do, the advanced technology education, is training the next generation of our workforce to be able to work with these kinds of instruments. So for, I know Wheeling High School, they have a very active manufacturing environment around them that put in first manufacturing instruments like CNCs and things, and then moved on to this nano lab.
Okay. Let's quickly go through the other ones. Now, I know I'm just asking you, throwing this at you to give a ballpark, but how about an SEM? What's it going to cost?
An SEM. Now, that's a great question. Normally, when you talk traditionally about those large-scale SEMs, you're looking at $500,000 to $1 million. But like I said, with the new, in the past 5 years, really, there's been a lot of advancement in desktop scanning electron microscopes. So a desktop scanning electron microscope will be somewhere between $60,000 to $80,000, $90,000. And then I think someone asked about EDS, which is elemental analysis. That typically can come with an SEM, and that will put you more up into the $150,000 kind of realm, plus or minus.
Okay, next. Yeah.
So that's still much less than a smaller SEM, like in the $200,000.
Now, I think the AFMs, you can get one that's going to cost less, right?
Yes. The AFMs, you can actually get ones that are less than somewhere around the $30,000 range. And they're quite functional. So you are moving a little, you're certainly less than that $50,000 mark. But still, it's not something that you're going to fundraise for,
right,
per se.
Okay, here's a bit more expensive. What about TEM?
TEM, that's a great question. As far as I know, there, I haven't come across a lot of desktop TEMs at this stage, though I know that that is in the works and things are getting closer. But at this stage, most TEMs will still be larger size and probably will keep you from getting one outside of the cost, again, in the hundreds of thousands, but also the fact that you probably would need these liquid nitrogen doers and a little bit more infrastructure than you would with some of these other instruments.
Last one, what about a scanning tunneling microscope? What do you think?
Now, that's funny. This is the one where sees atoms, but I actually know that there are some on the market for in the $15,000
wow.
range. So, yeah, you can actually get some that are in a lower range. Now, you can also move up to the IBM sizes and get some very expensive ones, but the STM can start at a very low cost point, and is now you're getting into the accessible
yeah.
realm for a school.
Interesting. Diane, let me talk here for a moment to let people know that they'll be able to access this recording or send it to their friends. There'll be a handout. They can see a PDF of your slides, and thank you for doing that. And that's going to be right on nanoforme.org/webinars.php, or just navigate there by going to nanoforme. So everyone, we're going to stay on with Diane, if she's willing, just for another minute to do one final question. This officially ends the webinar, but we're going to keep going here and talk for just another minute, if that's okay for you, Diane.
Sounds great.
Here's a question that came in. If you don't have the funds to do this, are there simulations? Are there some way you can expose your students to actually operating this stuff, maybe through simulations or other opportunities? What do you think?
Yeah, certainly. There's, as you said, there are these remote access abilities, and I think that's fantastic. Possibly your local university, one that's near you, or your state school, if you're in a remote location, they might be able to give you remote access. Or even today with the with things like Skype and webinars like this, just being able to Skype with a professor or someone who has this instrumentation would be great for your students. You know, they could send samples in. But then there are simulations online, especially, again, with the ASM, but some others. It can simulate how these work and then what kind of data you might get. But in my opinion, there's a really great value to seeing, whether that's using Skype or remote access, is really seeing something that you touched and you put together and you sent in and being able to image it on one of these instruments.
That's cool. You know, for those of us remaining online, if you'll notice in the chat window, you'll see nanoforme.org/remote-access. And our colleague Dan Kavanaugh there actually runs that access. And, you know, Diane, he's done remote access points over the entire globe. And, of course, he has to worry about the time zone. But he's done them everywhere, not only locally. And I always wondered, you know, did students get involved in this remote access? Well, he interacts with them so well that they feel like they're actually running the equipment themselves. You know, they get that sense of it. So I think it's an opportunity. I've talked with high school folks who, you know, they say, okay, let's get together a consortium of five high schools and purchase one of these AFMs, and then we'll each get it for 2 weeks at a time. I actually think that can work, and these things are robust enough that you can move them around, isn't it? Isn't that the case?
Yes. Yes, and in fact, I think there are some school systems that are doing something exactly like that, that they'll have the two-week courses, and that really helps the teachers with, you know, already having content and not having to create things as they go. Nice packages.
Good.
But these systems are quite robust now and can be shared.
Excellent. One last thing, folks, and then we're going to close officially for today. You can see Dan Kavanaugh's email there, DWC174. Why don't they have, Diane, just regular emails like everybody else? I'm just joking. At psu.edu. How about Dan at psu.edu? But that's another story. Diane, it was a real pleasure today. You know, we sensed easily your enthusiasm for this whole topic and the excitement of working with students. And those probing questions that you say, well, you know, things like color, and it really gets some thinking. I really like that aspect of your presentation today, so thank you.
You're very welcome. Thank you for inviting me to do this. I hope everyone got something out of it, if only learning about a Blu-ray.
that actually was very cool. You know, we have an opportunity to do a number of these webinars. I'm just so pleased. You can see many people commented in the chat window how interesting they thought this webinar was. So thank you again, and I want to say the same thing to you personally. So thanks.
Thank you.
Okay, so everyone, this officially ends our webinar. Diane, I'm going to disconnect the audio portion of this, and I'll follow you up with you by email. But thank you again for being part of it today.
Have a great weekend, everyone.
Goodbye, everyone.